This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. As our Project Milwaukee series on black male incarceration has continued, we've shifted our focus to potential solutions to the issue. Earlier this week, our Real Talk contributor introduced us to two guests on the Community Advisory Board at the Felmers Cheney Correctional Center. Inmates at the minimum security facility hold down real-world jobs during the day before returning to prison at night. The goal is to equip the inmates with job skills so they're less likely to reoffend. That's also at the heart of the internationally acclaimed Shakespeare Behind Bars. For almost 20 years, the program has used the works of Shakespeare to help inmates of all races and creeds explore what it means to be human. And from its beginnings in one prison in Kentucky, the Shakespeare Behind Bars program has been adopted in 10 prisons now in two states. Its founder, Kurt Tofteland, hopes it continues to grow. In addition to his work with Shakespeare Behind Bars, Tofteland has more than 30 years of professional and academic theater experience, both as a director and an actor. He's also a Fulbright scholar and published essayist and poet. He'll be teaching classes and giving a public talk tonight at UW Waukesha entitled What Dreams May Come. He joins me on the phone now from his home in Minnesota. Kurt, welcome to Lake Effect. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Why Shakespeare? What was it about the works of Shakespeare that led you to think that you could do some good behind bars where maybe other playwrights wouldn't be so helpful?
Shakespeare is, as far as I'm concerned, the best writer about the human condition. He understands the human condition more deeply than other writers that I have worked with. And he has a length and breadth of works that go for a number of years. He had a long writing career. He wrote 37-plus plays. He wrote 154 sonnets. He wrote a couple of long poems. So he's quite prolific. And his use of introspection, what he was interested in was the inner life of the characters, thus the monologues, the soliloquies that the characters deliver when they talk to the audience. They're sharing their inner thoughts. And the great scope of comedy, tragedy, history. There's nothing that anyone is experiencing right at this moment in time that I can't go to his canon and find scenes or poems that approximate what it is that person is going through.
And so what made you then take the leap and say, I'm going to take this to inmates and I'm going to work with them using the works of Shakespeare in hopes that it improves their lives?
I was a producing artistic director of Kentucky Shakespeare for 20 years, and while I was there, I created an education department that began to serve kindergarten through 12th grade students with the works of William Shakespeare. Each age group was developmentally appropriate material for them. And while doing that, was working in the middle and high schools, and I could see that there was a lot of conflict going on. They were difficult schools. So I created a conflict resolution workshop that I could take to the middle and high schools and using the works of William Shakespeare, and had some success with that and began to think, how could we expand that part of it to take conflict resolution into the community, into the areas that the schools were located in that had high crime and poverty surrounding them. And I read in the newspaper, the Courier Journal, about a sociology professor, Dr. Kurt Bergstrand from Bellarmine University, who had created a program called Books Behind Bars. And he was working with a couple of middle school teachers, and his wife was a psychologist at the Luther Luckett Correctional Facility in LaGrange. She handpicked a group of inmates, and each group then read a novel by F.E. Hinton. And he chose Hinton because she writes teenagers as protagonists and the antagonists. Her most famous book's The Outsiders, which was made into a film. And I called him up and asked if I could take him to lunch because I thought I could learn something from his work with the inmate side. I hadn't been in prison, hadn't worked with inmates. And we had lunch, and he told me about the program and how it works. The kids read the same novel as the inmates. The kids were brought to the prison. They went through all of the security to get to the inner sanctum of the visitor's room and sat down with the inmates and then had a discussion, a facilitated discussion about the book and the characters and what happened in it. And I said to him, that's great. I know that it engages participants on an intellectual level. It engages them on an emotional level. They feel empathy for the characters. I said, have you ever thought about using drama, and in particular the works of William Shakespeare? And he said, no, I don't know anything about drama or theater and have limited knowledge of Shakespeare. Why would I do that? And I said, because when you read, you don't get the same depth as you get when you inhabit the character, when you inhabit Romeo and when you inhabit Juliet and Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. But the roots are much deeper because you're now delving into human behavior and you have to bring the truth to those characters and what it is that they're going through. He loved the idea and asked me to be his partner and create a Shakespeare component to Books Behind Bars. So in the spring of the year, the last thing that the students did is they read a play by Shakespeare. They found a scene, and the same thing happened with the inmates, and they produced that scene. They brought the two groups together, and they performed for each other. So that was how conflict resolution moved from outside the prison to the inner prison, because I had such a great time working in the women's prison and the men's prison that I asked Dr. Julie Bartow, who was the other psychologist at Luther Luckett, if I could come back. And after coming back about six or eight times to work with these men on Romeo and Juliet, which was the play they had selected, I told the men that I would continue to come back as long as the prison let me in and as long as they didn't waste my time. And that was 19 years ago, 1995.
Yes, you're about to hit your 20th anniversary with this. And, I mean, the numbers really kind of tell the story, because if you look at the national average of about 60% of recidivism, inmates who've gone through Shakespeare Behind Bars, I mean, it's less than 6%.
That's really, people say, how do you know this works? Because everybody's interested in a way to measure something. And I say, well, I'll just give you one statistic. And the reality is this, is that the national average hovers closer to 70%. And really, that's a false number. It's government playing with statistics, because many places, many states have this policy that if an inmate's been on the street for 2 years without committing a crime and being convicted of it and comes back to prison, they aren't recidivism. It's called a new crime. The reason they do that is they just don't want the public to know what a dismal failure our American industrial prison complex really is. So it would hover much higher, closer to 85, 90%. Our recidivism rate is not done that way. If you've been in the program and out for 10 years, doesn't make any difference how long you're out. You commit a crime, you're convicted, you come back to prison. I count you as recidivism, because it's just easier to tell the truth than make something up. And ours is less than 6% over a 19-year period.
Again, the numbers are stunning. And obviously something is working. How do you choose the inmates, or do the inmates choose you? How does that work?
Well, it's quite different now. At the flagship program that the documentary by Philomath Films called Shakespeare Behind Bars is about, that's the program that's our longest running program. We have 14 other programs in Kentucky and in Michigan. We work in other adult facilities, male, female. We work with juveniles and co-gender juveniles and inside corrections and just outside those that are on probation. And each program is uniquely designed for the population that we're going to serve. And how the participants are chosen is always through volunteer. If you make something mandatory, then you create already resistance that they're being made to do something. So we just open it up and offer it as a voluntary program, and we gather our group from their volunteering. Now, where we have been for a number of years, certainly at Luther Luckett for 19 years, we don't have any trouble getting inmates. What someone does who wishes to join the group is he finds someone who is a core member of the group and asks that person to sponsor them. They then come in as an apprentice, and they spend 1 year working on the play, and then they become a core member, and they can do that same thing. In a program here now in Michigan, where I relocated 5 years ago, I started two adult programs, one which mirrors the program in Kentucky in that it is adult males in a medium security prison. We don't do multiple productions of Shakespeare like we do in Kentucky. I decided after 13 years of doing that, I knew how to do that. And after replicating the program around the world, that I knew how to do it. And I wanted to really create a program where I didn't know what would happen. So that program is much more mentorship and leadership skills within prison and when the inmates get out to go back to their communities. And I also just started a brand new program called The Journeyman for 18 to 21-year-old males. That's the most violent group in the prison. They also come in with the shortest bits, but when they come back with a new crime, it's 30 years to life on average is what happens when they come back. So we're trying to reduce the violence in prison with this age group and also reduce the recidivism rate of them coming back in with longer bits. In the juvenile center that I work, the Cogender Juvenile Center, there's 40 kids there. There are 5 pods, 8 kids in each pod, and it's just when I'm there, an open invite for anyone from any of the pods can come down and participate. I have about a 75-80% participation rate there. And then I work in a what is the equivalent, I guess, of a prison school system there. The kids are still on probation, but they're released from detention. So they come to school and they work on their GEDs because we want them to get their high school education. And a lot of them have done something that got them expelled from the public or private schools and they can't go back. So in Ottawa County where I work, they created a school where the kids can come and continue their high school education. That's also totally volunteer. The power is in volunteer, them choosing to do the program rather than being forced to do the program.
Well, and part of that choice is that there's something about Shakespeare that calls to them, too. Do you find that there are particular works that speak to them more than others?
It's really, again, it's quite unique. The program that's in Kentucky, that, as I said, the flagship, we're in our 19th year. We're producing Much Ado About Nothing this year. The play is chosen, the men cast themselves, and then they spend a year working on the play, and then we perform it with costumes and sets and props with the men playing the female roles. We have invited audiences that come from the yard. The inmates' families come and see a performance, and then we open it up to the public and bring people in to see the performance. And those guys will say they've done a number of comedies, like Much Ado About Nothing is comedy, but the majority of them prefer the tragedies or the history because of the grit that's contained in the tragedies and the histories. Although in his comedies, there's also great grit, too. They're not just laugh times. There's lots of serious subjects that are being explored. But they prefer the darker of his writing. In Michigan, where I work, we use art theater and Shakespeare to get at what it means to be a human being. And again, the guys gravitate much more towards the more introspective and darker characters like Macbeth, like Richard III, Richard II, those kinds of monologues. And they prefer the darker exploration of the interior life of the characters.
One of the things I was struck by in your values and your mission statement is that the very first thing that you say that you want to do is to develop a lifelong passion for learning in these folks. It's not a love of theater. It's not a love of Shakespeare. It's learning.
Yeah, exactly. And this is not universally true. I thought this was true when I first went in. I thought everyone in prison was a bad learner, dropped out of school, was a juvenile delinquent. That's not true. I've had men that have PhDs, educated all the way to the far end of the spectrum of education, down to people that have third grade reading levels, that didn't finish school, that have learning challenges, etc. And oftentimes in our education system, you know, it's that population that gets abandoned, that we sort of cast off and throw away. That has nothing to do with their intellectual level. In fact, what we discover when these men and women start working on Shakespeare, and part of the joy of working on Shakespeare is the fact that he's quite complex. He has vocabulary that's not a narrative of the street. You have to look words up. You have to try to understand the meaning of words based in his time and how that word has changed. So there's lots and lots of discussion about that. What they discover is that, oh, I don't know this, but there is a way to find out. And what they also discover sitting in that circle is they're deeply respected, not for what it is that they can't do, but for what it is that they do. And it creates a safe place to begin to explore. And time and time and time again, kids that don't do very well in school, that dropped out, they discover, gee, I'm not stupid. I was told by my school that I was stupid. I was told perhaps by my family and ultimately by society that I'm stupid, but I'm not stupid. I can find out the information, and it just creates this quest for learning and this quest for open dialogue and discussion and discernment and all these things that you want people, human beings, to be educated about, but they weren't educated in that way because they ended up being the cast-offs and then, of course, following a path of poverty and into crime, et cetera, and led them to prison.
When you come to places like UW-Waukesha to give lectures and to teach classes, what are you hoping to impart to those students? This is not a prison population, and these are people who may not even know anyone who's in prison and have no contact with it other than maybe on television. So what are you hoping to, you know, how are you hoping to meld those two worlds?
Well, I've been doing these speaking engagements and teaching at good colleges and universities across the country and done conferences around the world. And when I ask the question, how many of you in the audience know someone who's in prison? A third of the hands go up. Sometimes people are embarrassed to raise their hand, but there is no one in any audience that doesn't know someone that's in prison. When we have 1 in 99 Americans in prison, and we have 1 in 31 Americans who are attached in some way to the judicial system because they're out on parole, 1 in 31, the stats are just in your favor. You're going to find people that have family members or people that they know in prison. You don't have to dig back. In fact, I would venture to guess that in any family, anywhere, that if you go back a few generations, you're going to find someone of their family, of their kin, of their genetic makeup that served time. So what society would like you to believe, what the media would like you to believe, is that everyone in prison is Charlie Manson. That's not the case. People are in prison for three reasons. One is when we closed our mental institutions down, these patients had nowhere to go, so they went to three places. They went to the graveyard, they went to the streets, or they went to prison. And I'm going to be a bit exaggerative, but about a third of the population in prison is mentally ill. About a third of the population has drug, alcohol, addiction issues. And they committed crime in order to feed that addiction. And then about a third of the population are actually criminals. And what you do is when you throw those three groups together, you don't really have the money to be able to offer treatment programs to be able to help correct behavior. And the way that I look at it is corrections is about correcting behavior. Well, how do you correct behavior? You don't do that for punishment. There's no punishment that you can put on somebody that corrects behavior. The only way to correct behavior is through education, through programs like Shakespeare Behind Bars and the many other programs that exist to help people correct their behavior. So what I'm there to do is to just give a window into one program, one prison, in one state, but it's to give them an insight.
How has all of this work informed your other directing? Because I know you direct outside of prison. You have quite an active directing career. What has doing this work done for you as an artist?
Yeah, it's informed everything that I do as an artist. And that includes in corrections and outside in the professional world, in the academic world, doesn't make any difference. It's informed me, and it's much deeper. I'm a better artist. I'm a better human being. I'm a better director. I'm a better actor. I'm a better playwright, better teacher, all of those things because of the work that I do. Because the work is about human behavior. And when you dig into human behavior, particularly with someone that perhaps, like Macbeth, kills somebody, when you dig into that behavior, it becomes quite insightful about unpacking what it is that led them to kill another human being. And it's all about what it means to be a human being. After years of doing this work inside corrections, outside of corrections, in the professional world, in the academic world, I've distilled it down into four questions. The four questions that all the work emanates from is: question one is, who am I? Number two is, what do I love? Number three is, how will I live my life knowing I will die? And the last question is, what's my gift to humankind? And you can use those questions on your own personal journey, or you can use those questions when you're working with people on their journey, and you can use those questions when you're looking at a character in a play. It's certainly, from my standpoint, that's what I'm interested in, but you can look at those same questions in a novel or in a poem or in anything that's talking about human behavior. It's absolutely informed everything for me, and continues to inform me on this journey that I'm on.
Well, Kurt, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you a little bit about that journey. Looking forward to having you here in Waukesha, and long may the Shakespeare Behind Bars programs continue.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much.
Kurt Tofteland is the award-winning founder of the internationally acclaimed program Shakespeare Behind Bars, which uses the works of Shakespeare to help inmates explore what it means to be human and to help them gain the skills they need to lead productive lives once they're released from prison. Tofteland will give a talk tonight on the campus of UW-Waukesha entitled What Dreams May Come. There's more information on our website, wuwm.com/lake effect. And of course, there's more information about our fund drive at wuwm.com/give and right here with Mitch Dyke, who's sitting across from me in the studio. Hi, Mitch.
Hi there, Bonnie. It's great to be here. Great to have everybody already participating in this Spring into Action membership drive. This is the third day of the drive. Business has been brisk, as they say, but it could be brisker during this hour of Lake Effect. $875 is our goal this hour. We can do it with your support when you call 414-227-3210 or you go online to wuwm.com/give and you become a sustaining member. It would be great to have your sustaining membership carry us through another year, another 2 years, another 5 years worth of Lake Effect programming. Give at the $5 a month level and you can take advantage of the WUWM travel tumbler. It's an aluminum I think it's aluminum anywhere, stainless steel. It's a nice metal tumbler that is insulated. It'll keep your drink warm or cold, and it has the WUWM logo. So look for that at wuwm.com/give or call 414-227-3210.
And you know, one of the things that's great is you're also supporting programs like Lake Effect and the kind of interview that you just heard from Kurt Tofteland. I mean, what a great program that is that he started about 20 years ago and has since, there are like, I think there are 10 programs now in two states, 10 programs in various prisons, and they're trying to expand it. The recidivism rate is about less than 6%, and so it's one of those great success stories that we love to have here on Lake Effect, and that's exactly what you're supporting when you call 414-227-3210 or go to wuwm.com/give. And thanks. Coming up next, the importance of regular screenings for colon cancer, even if you're well under the age of 50. We'll be back with that conversation in just a moment when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.